Today's Teshel will be on case 87 in the Book of Equanimity, the Book of Serenity. It's entitled Sushan's Existence and Non-Existence. Introduction. When the door is about to close, with one push it opens. When the boat is about to sink, one stroke of the oar and it turns. The canyon enters the valley. There's no way of return. The peaks cross the sky. There is a gateway. Tell me, where does it go? Case. When Sushan went to Guishan, he immediately asked, I hear you have a saying, expression and no expression are like vines clinging to a tree. If suddenly the tree falls and the vines die, where does the expression return? Guishan laughed out loud. Sushan said, I came 1,000 miles selling cloth mats. How can you play with me? Guishan called to an attendant, get some money to repay this old codger. Finally, Guishan told him, later on, there will be a one-eyed dragon who will point it out to you. Later, Sushan came to Ming Zhao. He told the preceding story. Ming Zhao said, Guishan could be right to be straight and true from the beginning to the end, only he didn't meet one who knows. Sushan also asked again, when the tree falls and the vines die, where does the expression return? Ming Zhao said, renewing Guishan's laughter again. At these words, Sushan had an awakening. Then he said, Guishan actually had a sword in his laughter. Verse. The vines die, the tree falls. He asked Guishan. Big laughter, ha ha. Is it indeed casual? In the laugh there is a sword. He sees through it. Word and thought have no road. Gone are all machinations. So this is the third day of our beautiful spring sesshin. Another incredibly beautiful day. Probably temperature is going to be in the 70s. And the sun is shining, the birds are singing. This morning we were working in the kitchen and we heard like a jackhammer sound. And at first I was concentrating on cutting up the papaya, which is the most important item for breakfast. You know? And it's got to be cut properly, and there needs to be plenty of it, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm cutting the papaya and concentrating, and in the corner of my mind, I'm aware of this drrrr, 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 and I just tuned it out. But then I became aware of it, and I said, where is that coming from? And Ray was in the kitchen, and he said, that's coming from a jackhammer out on the street. So I went out, I peeked through the door, and there was no sound out from the street. And I went into the storeroom there, and there was this, you know, like that, and a jackhammer sound. And I thought, what the hell? You know, so where is that coming from? And as it turns out, after we were all set and waiting for the opener to cook, I went outside and I could see that there was a woodpecker up there, and he was giving that crazy laugh, you know. He was making that crazy sound, the woodpeckers, and was pecking on the chimney, to the vent pipe for the water heater in the kitchen. And he was going at it with such incredible energy. I mean, I really felt worried for the poor guy, or girl, I don't really know. But I mean, it was like, So it was like, I hope that poor bird is okay. But the thing that was so stunning was the energy of the bird, the energy of that bird, you know. It was really just really pounding away, you know. It was just with great vigor. I was very impressed by that. I mean, sometimes you realize that there's a kind of, you know, woodpeckers are probably smarter than we think, you know. When I was growing up, people were told that animals were much inferior to humans in terms of intelligence. And I remember reading in a Life magazine book, the Life magazine, which is now out of business, and Time magazine used to put out a series of illustrated books that were filled with beautiful photographs and text. They did different series, the Time Life books of American history, and there was the Time Life books of science, you know, and they, you know, natural science. And I remember reading in one of the Time Life books, they had like, all the animals laid out in terms of intelligence, right? And that, like, at the bottom was the, at the extreme left hand side was the amoeba, right? You know, stupidest of all, right? And then at the other, and it went through, you know, it went through little animals like shrew, you know, mouse, and then up to cat, and dog, and then a pig, and then, some other, maybe, I don't know what, and then finally the human at the top. And it was like the human was the biggest of all the animals on the picture, on the scale. It was a scale reading from left to right. And the human was like represented as the most intelligent creature. It was interesting to say, well, where's the deer? And there's a, you know, deer here, they're between, you know, a cat and I don't know what, you know, a possum or something, you know. And they had worked it all out, all the intelligence of the animals. Now people discover all the time that animals are much more intelligent than we thought. You know, it turns out that even fish are much smarter than we thought, and birds are much smarter. It turns out that monkeys are smarter than we are in many ways. See, it's just everything's really been stood on its head. It turns out that a monkey can hold more numbers in its head than a human. Isn't that interesting? Like a monkey, I'm saying. A chimp. A chimpanzee can hold more numbers in its head than a human. Now, they don't count with numbers, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4. But if you, they've devised certain tests to see how many different objects in groupings they can remember at once. And in other words, you could have 3 blocks here, and 2 blocks here, and 4 blocks here, and 3 blocks here. And you could scramble them up, you know, and the chimpanzee could remember where they're supposed to go. And the human is stumped, right? They go, I don't know, you know. So they said that, you know, even though chimpanzees don't have our language ability, they have this incredible memory for numerical sequences and also arrangements of numbers. And they said it would have made a lot of sense for a chimp to be able to say, okay, on this tree there's 3 chimps, on that tree there's 2 chimps, the tree to my left has 4 chimps, including the alpha male, over here on this tree there's 7 chimps. And they can hold all that in their mind effortlessly, whereas we would go, now wait, on tree number 2, how many chimps, you know? And fish are smarter than we thought. Birds are smarter than we thought. But even findings like this are, I think, very primitive. You know, the idea that animals are not as dumb as we thought. Even saying that, you know, isn't it remarkable that chimpanzees can hold these numbers in their heads doesn't really go far enough. You know, I think our concept of intelligence is very limited, very stultifying, you know, because we tend to think of intelligence as being like in our brains, and it's a personal quality, and we don't really understand, I think, that intelligence is like a relationship. You know, intelligence is really like a relationship. Basically, it might seem stupid that a woodpecker is hammering on a chimney. We know that, it's not a tree, there's no bugs in there, right? So that seems stupid to us. But all the same, there's something really, I thought there was something really interesting about that woodpecker. The woodpecker is really vitally alive, you know, vitally alive. And it has this energy that's just breathtaking, you know. I admit, you know, it's pecking on a wooden, it's pecking on a metal sleeve. There's no bugs in there, so it seems stupid. But on the other hand, I just kept admiring that. It was really, I think we were all sort of like amazed at the power of the little bird, you know. And this power comes from someplace, you know. I think the bird has this incredible vitality, you know. And I think often we don't have that kind of vitality. Many people get up in the morning and they're tired, and they go through their lives and they're sort of like dragging their asses, you know. I'm fascinated by that. You know, I myself, at various parts of my life, I think I was mildly depressed when I was a kid at times. And it just seemed very hard to get out of my chair and walk across the room sometimes, you know. Maybe I was just a lazy kid, I don't know. But I often, even though kids are supposed to have a lot of energy, I sometimes didn't have a lot of energy. And my father got tired of my brother and I hanging around the house all the time and lying around all day. And he signed us up for the swimming team. And, the swimming team was competitive group of people on the base. There was a young man who was, his name was Keith. He was the coach. And he really wanted to produce like Olympic athletes. It was crazy, but he really wanted to. So the base swimming team was pretty good. You know, you would get there at like 5 in the morning, and you would hit the pool, you'd dive into the pool, and you were supposed to do like 25 or 30 warm-up laps. Just, in other words, up and back, say 15 times, just to warm up. And then the practice starts, the sprints. And if you know anything about competitive swimming, you start on a block. There are these starting blocks at one end of the pool, and you leap off into the water, and then you stroke as fast as you can to the end of the pool. There's a special way of turning around and then coming back out, team members were all in lines behind the blocks, so there might be 5 blocks. And behind each block, there would be 5 kids, see? And what you do is the first kid is up on the block and he dives off, or she dives off, hits the water, and each group of kids are competing against each other. So 5 kids jump off, they all go to the end of the pool, turn around and come back, and then it's the next group, and then it's the next group. And, you know, it was, to me, this was terrifying because I wasn't that good of a swimmer. And I didn't like getting up at 5 in the morning. And I was also very out of shape at that time because I had just been sort of lying around. But the interesting thing was that I really got into swimming, you know. I really began to enjoy this experience. And, you know, when you would hit the water, it would be, even though it was summer, when you hit that water, it was cold, especially early in the summer. The water would be, like, really cold. And also, there was, it was filled with chlorine. At the end of the swimming session, when I would go home, my eyes would be bright red from chlorine. And I don't know what effect that has had on my genetic situation, but couldn't have been good. But that was, they used to put, for health reasons, all this chlorine in the pool. But the thing was, it was incredibly stimulating to do this. You know, it was crazy, really, to get up early in the morning, come down and swim in these competitive heats, they're called, and the coach would be barking at you the whole time, right? But somehow it felt really good to do this. It felt really good. And if somebody had asked me why it felt good, I couldn't really have told you. You know, I couldn't really have said why it feels good. Did I like getting up at 5? No. It was good training for Zen later on. Did I like the competitive heats? No. Did I like Keith yelling at me? No. And by the way, when you swim like that, if you really push hard, you can get muscle cramps in your arms and also under your arms, along the sides of your rib cage. And you get the, you are not allowed to stop. So if you try to stop, the coach will go, no, swim it out, swim it out, swim it out. And you just have to, you're supposed to swim until the cramps go away. And indeed, sometimes they go away. That's like a memorable event, you know. And I would go home and be so happy, you know. It's crazy because nobody in our group actually made it to the Olympics. We went to the Junior Olympics once, the AAU Olympics in Richmond, and nobody on the team made it to the Regional Olympics. But nevertheless, there was something really exciting about this experience, if you think about it, we were, you know, there was a cubicle of cement, made of cement, filled with water. Somebody had put lines down the cubicle, and we were racing to the end and back. And in a certain sense, it was totally useless activity. But in another sense, it was very stimulating. Now, it made us feel so alive, you know. And there's a kind of energy in life that people can tap into, you know. Sometimes it comes from doing something like swimming. And sometimes it comes from doing something that's exciting, you know. Every once in a while I'll read something that makes my heart pick up, you know, my heart rate pick up. Or, you know, I like to go to, I don't do it much anymore, but I used to love to go to museums and look at paintings. And sometimes I'd look at a painting and just feel like this energy pulsing through my body. And Zen is very much about this too, you know, very much about getting in touch with a kind of energy. I think it exists on a level that's deeper than the discriminating mind, you know, than the discriminating mind. So, you know, basically the discriminating mind sort of reasons like this, you know, I don't want to go to swimming practice because, look, I'll never become an Olympic swimmer, you know, obviously. I'm not cut out for that. I don't like to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't like the chlorine. The coach is rude, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the discriminating mind has all of these expectations, and it sizes things up in a certain way. But then, you know, if you do it, sometimes you think, man, this is fun. You know, this is really fun. And it's one of those things we might do when we're kids, you know. And then as adults, we might or might not remember why we did it. And if you ask somebody who was in competitive swimming, you know, what did you like about it? They might say, it built character. But I think that's just belonging, you know. There's something about the activity in itself, just doing it in itself, that can be very, can bring you to life, bring you to life. And I think Zazen is like that too. Somehow, you know, when I'm sitting on the cushion, I can feel like I'm tapping into a kind of life energy. I'm not moving as fast as I can through the water. I'm sitting very still, and I'm watching my breath. But it's like the mind has these different layers, you know, and the top layer, I think, is very self-conscious, very inhibited, you know. It's the mind that society has created most fully, you know. So, you know, basically, it says, you must do this, you shouldn't do that, you know. It's constantly analyzing itself. It's constantly second guessing. It's constantly trying to make sure it's doing the right thing, you know. By the time you're an adult, you've spent a lot of your time on that level, right? You spend a lot of time there. But underneath that level, there's a number of levels of the mind. But underneath that level, there's like the level you're all familiar with, which is underneath the rational mind and the self-aware mind. There's like this mind that's full of pieces of thoughts and fragments of thoughts. And then there's a level that is like memory. And then there's a level that's like imagination, right? But somehow, when we go deeper, we find this other kind of consciousness, which is so alive. And I think it draws on the whole being, you know, not just the discriminating mind, but there's a kind of deeper intelligence, which harmonizes the whole being with the world. And that relationship is a deeper kind of intelligence. And every once in a while, you know, I think sitting is like groping towards this situation, groping towards this experience of this life energy, you know. A lot of the time when we're sitting, we're just trying to sort of drop down into the deeper layers of the mind. And if you watch the breath will take you down, down, down through the layers of the mind. And of course you pop up again, and then you go back down and you pop up again. But little by little, you're sort of getting down to the deeper layers of the mind. When you get down to the bottom of the mind, it looks blank and dark, you know, or it might look blank and light. And you just have to stay there for a while, But that condition is very purifying. You know, that state of being is very purifying. I'm sure you've noticed this, you know. I used to give a talk on Buddhism for the religion department. And one of the things I used to point out is how different we are as adults from the way we were as kids, you know. Children aren't enlightened at all. They're very self-centered and so on. But they have a kind of natural spontaneity that's like that woodpecker, you know. I can remember behind our house on the base, we had dug, somebody actually had dug a big pit in the ground. And as kids, you know, we were walking along and we found this hole in the ground, and it was like a miracle, right? And it was like a fort. Of course, it's a fort, you know. And so put logs around it, and it was just like this miraculous place. And we had such energy, you know. We dragged these logs, we did all this stuff, and it was just the most stimulating experience for us. You know? Now, of course, it was just a hole in the ground, and these logs were not really a fort. You know, if you were an adult and you looked at this, you'd just think, well, thank God they're out of my hair, you know, for the afternoon. But the energy we brought to that, you know, was extraordinary. And you see this too with little kids, like out on the playground, you know. I myself have done like substitute teaching, you know, like, and if you have little kids out on a playground, you know, as soon as they get out of the building, they just explode, right? And they're running all around, and they're climbing all over everything. And by the time they're, say, 12th grade, if you let them out, you know, they might not leave the building, right? But they're no longer, you know, nobody just runs out and goes, wow, you know, snow, you know. Everybody's very careful, you know. You walk out of the building, you think, how do I look? You know, do I look like a geek? And you think, oh God, I'm always going to be a geek. You know, I'll never, right? Isn't this accurate? Right? So there's a kind of, spontaneity is lost. And there's a kind, you know, for 12 years, people are teaching you to be a self. And you're not really a self, you know, actually. People are like this beautiful energy, this beautiful life energy. Fundamentally, people are like this beautiful life energy. But we sort of teach it to think of itself as a self, right? And we name it Kurt, or we name it Bob, and we tell it it is this and it's not that. And we make it self-conscious, you know. In other words, we create a kind of alienated experience of the world. So by the time you're 18, you know, it's true, even little kids can have anxieties, but they're much less worried about how they come across to others. They're much more caught up in the moment. I can remember, once, coming out of our of my elementary school, it was an autumn day in Baltimore, and there were oak trees all around our school, and there were huge piles of leaves, and it was like we all came out of kindergarten, and as soon as we saw those leaves, it was like, wow, you know, everybody dove in, you know, and it was just the instant we saw them. Everybody, girls, boys, we were all like thrashing around in the leaves, and it was so fun, right? 12th grade, you know, how do I look? What did he mean by that? You know, oh, there's so-and-so I don't want to see. I'm mad at him, you know, or I like him, you know, or, you know, what a jerk. He's so uncool, you know, and that kind of thing, right? So something happens, you know, we internalize all of these standards, and we become like very tired, right? Very, you know, policing yourself all day, monitoring yourself, making sure you look appropriately, second guessing yourself, trying to please others, all of this gets to be really tiresome, really tedious, and a huge amount of energy just goes into monitoring the reactions of other people and trying to deliver an acceptable product to them in terms of behavior. You know, this is probably true for many social creatures, but we spend a lot of time in this artificial world, right? And it can become very tiresome and very stultifying, you know. And so by the time you're an adult, you can be, you know, you drag yourself through the day and you can feel very tired and very, lifeless. You know? So one way to think about Zen is that we lose contact with that beautiful energy, which is really fundamentally free, and we confine it more and more as we grow up, and it's only channeled into socially approved avenues, right? So in our culture, it's money. If you want to make money, we're happy to see you use your energy, right? So there's certain socially approved channels for human energy. And certain kinds of energy are not allowed, you know, and so on and so on. And so, you know, one day it just gets harder and harder to be like that little woodpecker and just get up in the morning and start banging away on the first thing you see with great vigor, right? To just jump out of bed and say, you know, I'm alive, this is beautiful, and so on and so on. You know, we're so, we get up and say, oh, I'm not this, I'm not that, and so on. You know how it is. So one way to think about Zen is that this is learning to be free again, right? Learning to be free again. And unlearning these very crippling social constraints, you know. These constraints can become absolutely, you know, like claustrophobic, you know. We're so afraid of saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing, making a mistake. And it becomes very difficult to ever be natural in life or feel calmly present in the moment. And so one way to think about Zen is that it's about getting back in touch with this vital energy, right? That's at the heart of life. And so, you know, we have to kind of like unlearn. It's just like deconditioning the mind. We have to unlearn all of these barriers that we've internalized. And so watching the breath is not just about watching the breath. It's about getting back to a layer of the mind or a level of the mind where it's possible to encounter the moment without all this cultural baggage, without all these ideas, all these assumptions. A lot of Zen is about getting back to this blank, empty mind. And then, you know, when you hear the sound of a bird or you hear the sound of a car, you know, you don't have a stereotypical response. You have a lively response and spontaneous response, you know. This is very important. You know, this is really so nurturing and so sustaining and so revitalizing. You know, here in the Zendo, you don't have to worry about being uncool, right? So, you know, one of the things we don't have to worry about in particular is, you know, it's like our appearance. You don't have to worry about that. You know, sometimes people cry, and it's okay to cry, you know. Yesterday I said that the Zendo is like the karma hospital. You know, this is like karma hospital. And we're sort of repairing the damage done to us by, you could say, by society, really, by growing. I mean, our culture is not an enlightened culture. It would be wonderful to live in a world where everybody a shared, where there was great equality and kindness, where all people wanted what was best for you. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Imagine, you know, if the whole society, everybody was looking out for everybody else, and everybody, the goal of everyone was to make everybody else happy, fulfilled, healthy. You know, it would be a world very different from the world we live in. It would be a very good world, you know, and maybe someday it will exist. But a lot of the time, people don't necessarily have our best interest at heart. And we get injured, we get closed up, and so we have to come to karma hospital. And we start watching the breath or working with Mu, and little by little, we begin to feel more open, more trusting, and more alive. And eventually, you know, that energy becomes really palpable. Really, you know, it's a feeble little trickle of energy, you know. You're in that blankness, and one day you feel a little something, a little energy. But it can become very powerful, great energy. And basically, when people go into the Dokusan room and call Mu, you know, you might think, what's that about? But the teacher is waiting to see if you've tapped into that energy or not. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what does this have to do with the koan? Oh, I was going to say, you know, something that has come up on occasion, and I'll have to say this again, is, you know, some people in this room wear robes. This is something that didn't exist in our sangha at one time. Even I just wore regular clothes, you know. But over the years, some people have started wearing robes. And eventually, if we have our own place, you know, everybody could order a robe and wear a robe in the zendo. It's actually more comfortable in some ways than wearing street clothes, you know. The people who are wearing robes in the room are people who have taken priest vows. And you might think, well, what's that all about, priest vows? And what does it mean to be a Zen priest? I mean, obviously, it doesn't mean you live in a monastery, because we don't have a monastery. One way to think about the people who wear robes is that they've made a particular personal commitment to Zen practice. People who take robes are people who have trained for a long time, 8 to 10 years, and they decided to make Zen a very, very important part of their life. They're basically saying, I'm taking personal responsibility for this practice, you know. And the robes basically make you like, if this is a karmic hospital, basically the people who wear robes are like nurses, right? Yeah, that's it, you know. So it's like, we're here to assist you, really. That's what the function of the robe is for. It's a way of saying, I'm at your service. And I'm here, people who take these vows are really saying, I will be a servant of other people, and I will help them to wake up. That's what it means. So it's expressing a commitment to be a good nurse in the karma hospital. You have to be your own doctor. You know, that's the thing about Zen. So basically, you're your own doctor, but we're here to, put on the band-aids and things like that. That's what robes are all about. Servant. I'm your servant. I'm at your disposal. I want to help you wake up. And I hope you don't think robes are pretentious or something like that. It means that a person is decided to take personal responsibility for the practice. In many groups, everybody wears a robe of some kind just because they're so comfortable. If we had our own building, that would make a lot of sense. Um, But anyway, what does this have to do with the koan, which probably made no sense at all? When Sushant came to Guishan, he immediately asked, "I hear you have a saying, expression and no expression are like vines clinging to a tree. If suddenly the tree falls and the vines die, where does the expression return?" Now, you know, this is a great koan because it's appealing to the top layer of our mind, the discriminating mind. If you say, I hear that you say expression and no expression are like vines clinging to a tree. That's so intellectual, right? It's so abstract. It's like sitting on the cushion and thinking, am I free or is everything I'm doing totally determined by fate? Free or fate, you know? And that kind of an issue is so unreal. It's totally intellectual. It has no experiential reality, and yet, you know, people worry about such matters. They've built their whole careers on such matters. You know? And you can feel very trapped by these kinds of choices in life, you know. So you might think, you might, sometimes we feel so boxed in. We feel so trapped. It's either this or that, right? And we think, oh my God, I've got to choose between, you know, this or that. You know, how can I choose? I love this, I love that, how can I choose? And we feel so boxed in. You go, if I take this, then I'll lose that. If I take that, then I'll lose this. And you can begin to feel so totally confined. And you know, Zen is a way of like smashing through that. It's just like, it just sweeps it away with the breath. And you suddenly realize that there's never just two choices. This is like an illusion. You know, it's never just like black or white, yes or no, on or off. There's a million different roads to follow in life. You know, you don't have to do what everybody else is doing. You know, you don't have to follow the road that everybody else is following. So basically, it's not necessary to accept the, you're freer than you think, you know, always. We're all freer than we think. And so sometimes if we stop thinking, we really begin to come alive. We really begin to feel wonderful. There's a kind of deeper intelligence, as I say, that we're tapping into on the cushion. And it means going down into the layers of the mind, to this place where there's no thought. And then, you know, if you're working through your obstacles, you can see everything with fresh eyes. And you can find possibilities you never dreamed of, you know, with your ordinary mind. And you begin to feel this beautiful life energy pulsing through you, and you can go up, you're like the woodpecker on the roof, you know. This unquenchable life energy. Really very beautiful, right? So anyway, this is day two of the sesshin here at Karma Hospital. The nurses and orderlies are ready to help, okay? And everybody's, I'm very glad you're here. Everybody here, I'm very, very glad you're here. And I want everybody to, find that energy and be brought back to life by it, because it's the most wonderful thing in the world. So.